I just wanted to give a brief overview of some of the work that we do in the Red Nation and some of the work that we do both at a quote-unquote national but also international scale, and why it's important to have organizations like the DSA as allies in this particular struggle. There are lessons to be learned from Standing Rock, and I think a lot of you have familiarity with that particular struggle, but I think it's important to put it into both a national context in terms of the Indigenous movement, where it's at, where it's going, as well as an international context, and how we're seeing many of the same kind of policies that we were fighting in the Obama era, now under the Biden era. I think it's important to kind of see a continuity between Obama, Trump, and Biden versus saying Biden is a kind of departure from the Trump administration. So first of all, I just want to say that the Water Protector Movement, as many of you know, isn't just an exclusively Indigenous movement. It's definitely led by Indigenous people. And it's not to say that the era of the Water Protector inaugurated water protectors as we know it today, or created them, or it's where it began. But nonetheless, there was something special that happened at Standing Rock. As Indigenous people, of course, we were water protectors prior to colonialism and have been since time immemorial. But there is something unique that happened at Standing Rock that is worthy of attention. And I think it's important to put into context the Obama presidency and its alliance with the fossil fuel industry specifically, that led to that particular struggle, and how we understood it as the Ocheti Shakoni and as Indigenous people, but also I think something that gets ignored, as anti-imperialists. And so I'll begin with the third point, because that might not be a point that is really kind of shared publicly or mainstreamed in a way that we talk about it in our home community. So first of all, it was under the Obama administration where we saw the rapid increase in domestic oil production, 88% to be exact, from the time he came into office to the time he left. And most of that was directed towards fracking. And we can kind of see this playing out now with the drums of war being beaten to essentially intervene, to pre-invade Ukraine, to prevent an invasion, right? And this is over the Nord Stream pipeline. And we see Biden trying to push North American gas companies to kind of take the place of Russian gas with the Nord Stream pipeline. And I would say very much in a similar vein, the Obama administration saw America and energy independence, which was his policy, as a way to essentially wean the United States off of foreign oil imports. And it was under his administration that the United States became the first, for the first time in history since the 1970s, a net exporter of oil. And this coincided with the fracking revolution in 2008. And it was also a way that the Obama administration began to look at countries like Venezuela and which has the world's largest oil reserves, and began to say, we don't actually like these these alternatives to neoliberalism. And it was actually under Obama where we began to see the kind of heaviest and most deleterious sanctions against Venezuela. It was Trump implemented 213 during his administration, none of which Biden has repealed, but it was actually Obama's sanctions against Venezuela that actually set into motion what Trump later did during his administration. But what was fascinating about this particular moment in time is that his sanctions specifically targeted Venezuela's oil capacity and oil production capacity, because up until that point, the United States and the oil companies that were invested in Venezuela refused to kind of do technology transfers to allow Venezuela to refine its own oil. And a lot of it had been imported and sent to places like the Gulf of Mexico, where it's refined in places like Houston. And so the Obama administration began to target what it saw as like competitors, nations, and specifically not just oil competitors, but people who challenged U.S. hegemony within the global South, and specifically targeting Venezuela and Hugo Chavez, right? And for us as Indigenous people, we were like, You know, I first heard about Chavez when he began his heating relief program for Northern Indian reservations. My reservation actually received heating assistance during a very cold winter. And that's where I first began to understand what the Bolivarian Revolution was. And so when, you know, Standing Rock popped off, a lot of us were, you know, talking about the creation of oil pipelines, domestic oil pipelines within a geopolitical frame. And I don't think that really translated. A lot of people just think of us as like mystical, like people, like the Navi. We like to plug our braids into trees. We do a lot of praying, you know. That's kind of what gets the cameras, but I'm not going to do that today for you guys. I want to talk about the kind of anti-imperialist struggle and how we understand the geopolitics of oil production. So, you know, Obama canceled the Keystone XL pipeline, or at least the northern leg. He didn't cancel the southern leg, which was considered a domestic pipeline. It was transporting, it may have been transporting Canadian extracted or Canadian mined tar sands, but nonetheless, it was a domestic route. So President Obama approved 3/4 of the Keystone XL pipeline. He didn't kill the pipeline. He just killed the northern route, which crossed an international border, which fell outside his domestic oil policy or domestic energy production policy. The Dakota Access Pipeline actually fell within his domestic oil production policy. So it was something that he, you know, he essentially approved. But as we saw it play out on the ground, there's this really great interview that kind of got, you know, ignored the Democracy Now! Did with Winona LaDuke as she was like walking to the front line. And she said, the reason why, you know, the Dakota Access Pipeline is being built is because the U.S. has, you know, essentially waged war on countries in the global south like Venezuela. And it might seem counterintuitive to think about sanctions against oil companies in the global south when we're talking about climate justice. But it's really how we understand, you know, even as people who consider themselves water protectors and have led, you know, one of the most historic fights against oil and gas in both Canada and the United States, we understand like development, we understand imperialism, and we understand especially that the way that global south nations develop is definitely curtailed by the policies of the global north. And it's also to understand that within the context of the Cochabamba Accords, or which were created in 2010 in Bolivia, that they actually made a similar argument, something that we had participated in, you know, as indigenous activists, climate activists in the north. You know, we understand like we have to move towards and transition towards sustainable development, but we also understand that the way that the levels of consumption in the global north, you know, are unfair in how they impact the global south. And so a country like Bolivia, a country like Venezuela will never have the per capita carbon emissions or be responsible for the kind of the emissions, you know, levels per capita of countries like the United States and Canada, nor do they have the same level of climate debt. And in fact, they are, they would be considered nations that, you know, the United States and Canada owe climate debt to, right? Under the framework of the Cochabamba Accords.
Dedication to Sioux Tribe in Flint, Michigan. Fracking for more oil, more environment, more water to spoil. You see they poisoning the people out there in Flint. Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, they facing imprisonment. All because they took a stand, water protectors against military tactics and tankers.
That was a clip from a song called Water Protectors by Public Enemy. We return now to Nick Estes.
So this is something that we really thought about in terms of drafting the Red Deal, which I think the DSA has passed as, you know, a working document in collaboration with something like the Green New Deal. This is just a kind of a brief overview. I don't have a whole lot of time to get into a lot of the inner workings of that. But I think in this moment in time, when we are talking about the transition away from fossil fuels, we have to remember the importance of water protectors and the role that they played. So indigenous people in the United States make up around 1%, 1.5% of the total population. And I think it's around 3% in Canada. They're more visible, or what's considered a more visible minority in Canada than they are in the States. But given their kind of small, or given our small demographic size within both countries, Indigenous-led movements in Canada and the United States, according to in an Indigenous Environmental Network report that was issued last fall, we Indigenous-led movements are challenging a quarter of the carbon emissions from both Canada and the U.S. And so when we think about who are sort of the vanguards of the climate justice movement, it's not teenagers from Sweden, right? White teenagers from Europe who are actually the vanguards of these struggles, or those who get the kind of stage at COP26. It's actually land-based movements. And I think that's a really important kind of like factor that we have to consider, but also we have to understand that in this moment in time, the reality of transition is, it's a pragmatic concern by both capital and social movements. But I think in this moment in time, we've also ceded a lot of ground on the left, or lost a lot of ground on the left, over the question of extractive capitalism itself, because extractive capitalism isn't something that's unique to the fossil fuel industry. But as we've seen with, you know, Biden's own Build Back Better plan, or promises to transition away from the fossil fuel economy, and, you know, promises of electrifying the federal fleet, we know that those kind of resources that go into so-called green renewable technologies, which I would, you know, I think many of us would argue are essential in a transition to a post a fossil fuel economy, have to come from somewhere. And simply, the technology doesn't exist right now to not have like things like pure copper ore that has to be extracted from the earth itself. It can't be recycled, that goes into, you know, renewable technologies like electric cars. So you have to create new copper mines. You have to create new lithium mines. You have to find these resources to continue and to maintain the levels of consumption in places like the United States. You know, we might have heard of things like Line 3 and support, you know, movements like Line 3 or movements against the Dakota Access Pipeline. And we should support, you know, those struggles and understand that the number of water protectors who were arrested at Line 3 actually far exceeds those who were arrested at the Dakota Access Pipeline protests. We have to ask ourselves, why is it that one got more attention than the other one didn't? The same kind of resistance, is still the same. But also we have to ask ourselves why we don't know of movements such as the movement at Thacker Pass. I don't know if anyone has heard of this, but it's slotted to be one of the largest open pit lithium mines in Northern Nevada, which is being opposed by Shoshone and Paiute people, right? And so as we even as we move into kind of this green energy, you know, revolution or whatever, the kind of colonial extractive capitalism that defined the fossil fuel age is now defining the, you know, green revolution age. And there isn't a really, I think, a mature conversation about what that's going to look like for Indigenous people. Because it was under Obama and the National Defense Reauthorization Act that we got Resolution Copper, which, you know, set aside a Apache sacred site for Rio Tinto, which is an Australian mining company, to come in and create one of the world's largest copper mines, which will actually go about, you know, 2,000 to 3,000 feet below the surface, which will actually destroy the sacred landscape. And that's largely to meet, you know, America's projected energy needs, you know, that will be fed essentially by these green renewable technologies. And so that's really what, you know, at the heart of what we're talking about when we talk about the Red Deal. It's like we want to transition, but we want a just transition. That means, you know, that we move away not only from capitalism, but we also move away from the extractive colonial, you know, relationships that this government and these corporations have towards Native people. And what we learned in, you know, in the Dakota Access Pipeline struggle, as well as within the Line 3 struggle, that this is something that, you know, neither one of those struggles would have been possible nor successful to the degree that they were successful, even though they didn't stop the pipelines, had it not been for non-Indigenous allies. And so it's not just an Indigenous struggle, right? These are universal aspirations. Like, everyone drinks water, right? anyone can become a water protector. It's just that these struggles are grounded in Indigenous values as well as grounded in Indigenous leadership, and they're incredibly effective. And so I think in this era of, you know, global climate change, as well as an era where we are promoting alternatives, I think Indigenous people, whether you like it or not, are going to be at the forefront of this struggle. And it's how we work together in a way possible that, you know, is productive for understanding that this is a, you know, this is a land that we're going to have to share. It's not exclusively like Indigenous issues. They're everyone's issues. And so with that, I'll just open it up for questions because I'm out of time.